Welcome to episode 28 of Paws, Claws and Wet Noses, the Kiwi veterinary podcast celebrating all creatures, great and small, and the fantabulous professionals who look after them all. I'm your show host, Julie South. This week, episode 28 is part one of a two-part series with Dr. Francesca Brown of the Otago Polytechnic. If you don't know Dr. Francesca, she's a veterinarian who graduated from Massey University's class of 98. After graduating and gaining experience in clinical practice, Francesca moved to education and then into leadership in allied veterinary professional education at both Otago Polytech as head of the School of Veterinary Nursing and then nationally as the chair of the Educational Standards Committee for Allied Veterinary Professionals. Over her career, Dr. Francesca has seen firsthand and through her network of colleagues in the industry, both vets and allied veterinary professionals, the significant changes that personnel face. If you're attending the Combined Vet Nurse Vet Conference this year in Christchurch, coming up in June 2021, be sure to register for Dr. Francesca's presentation as part of the business track. Today and next week, Dr. Francesca shares her research findings from her recent study into whether it's actually possible to have healthy staff and healthy bottom lines in New Zealand veterinary clinics. So we know that it's possible to have it, but can it be done in New Zealand? Listen as she shares how her research was different to the many papers and books already written on this subject. As always, I'll put all links mentioned in today's show on the show notes page at pawsclawswetnoses.fm, episode 28. And if you haven't already, click the follow button on your favourite podcast channel so you don't miss out on future episodes of Paws, Claws and Wet Noses. It doesn't cost you anything to follow a podcast when you click follow.
An old vet told my father when he was a student in Glasgow. He said, if you want to be a success in veterinary practice, just keep the bowels open and trust the rest to God.
Nutrition's not an opinion, it's a science.
They called me that weird herbal needle vet, and I just remember thinking, well, I'm still going to do it, because I know it works, and I've got the research to back it.
From reminiscences of the real James Herriot's son, to pet nutrition, to acupuncture, the Vet Podcast discusses current animal health issues from around the world. I'm veterinarian Brian Greger from New Zealand. Just search for the Vet Podcast wherever you get your podcasts from.
Paws, Claws and Wet Noses is sponsored by VetStaff. If you've never heard of VetStaff, it's New Zealand's only full-service recruitment agency 100% dedicated to the veterinary sector. VetStaff has been around since 2015 and works nationwide, from Cape Reinga to the Bluff and everywhere in between. As well as helping Kiwis, VetStaff also helps overseas qualified veterinarians find work in Aotearoa, New Zealand. VetStaff.co.nz. Francesca, can you tell me what started your research, please? What made you look at it?
There was a couple of things. One is that I've worked in veterinary nursing education for many years, and I've seen through our connection through multiple clinics with students coming back, sort of reports that things are not always happy in vet clinics. And about 2012 to 2015, I did a graduate diploma in sustainable practice. And at that time, I was all about saving the environment. And when I was doing that study, I realised that actually until we had happy, healthy staff and teams, we actually wouldn't be able to focus on the environment. So that really switched me around. And now my focus has been very much on the well-being of staff in veterinary practice so that we can improve the longevity of, you know, veterinarians and also the allied veterinary professionals in veterinary practice as well.
When you talk about well-being, do you have a definition of well-being in veterinary clinics? What does that mean?
What we're talking about is staff being able to come to work and perform to their best of their abilities and do their job, which is to, you know, help animals and look after animal welfare, and to be able to do it where they feel safe so that they, you know, they're in an environment where they feel safe and happy and supported as well in that environment. And I think wellbeing also spreads down to the fact that they also are able to have their financial needs met as well while they're working as well. So they shouldn't be, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel to do a job just because they care about animals.
Can you tell listeners, please, the criteria for your research and, you know, the questions you asked and the types of clinics that, or how did you get respondents and then how did you choose them?
Sure. So what I decided to do is when I'd done my literature review, most of the literature I read felt very negative. It was kind of like everything's bad, you know, maybe you should, and at the end would be you should do this, this and this. And it felt as though it wasn't really empowering to people. So what I wanted to do was produce a piece of work that was a little bit more empowering. And that was to find some clinics within New Zealand who measured really highly on staff wellbeing, but were also meeting their profit margins as well. So I put out a call in VetScript, and I also use social media as well too. And it went through VetCounts as well. So it should have reached every veterinarian in the country and asked for criteria as if their practice was meeting their business financial plan. And to me, it was totally irrelevant how much that was because every business has different goals. But if they were meeting their goals or exceeding them and they felt that they had good staff wellbeing, that they should come forward. And so that was initially looking for employers. And yes, I didn't just stop there because we all know that employers' visions can be slightly different to actually what people think on the ground. So I started by, with those practices, interviewing each of those employers that came forward just to get a picture of what the practice was like and what they were doing and where they felt they measured, the practice measured around, you know, wellbeing, their financial, you know, both financial, social and environmental. Actually, I asked all of those questions. And then from those practices, I took all of them that were still willing to participate and I sent all of their staff work environment surveys. So a work environment survey was, at the time I actually hadn't heard of the Gallup 12 and it wasn't based off that. When I went back and reviewed it against the Gallup 12, I'd pretty much asked similar questions. But I think the questions I'd asked it was a little bit longer and I got quite a lot more information than I would have ever got out of the Gallup 12. And it was based on one that's been used repeatedly in education sectors as well. So I did, you know, it was based off something. And I got the staff to complete that. And then I looked for congruence between what the employer had said and what the employees said and chose three practices from that had matching. So where the employers were reporting good wellbeing and the clinic had as well.
How surprised were you with the results? Did you expect them to match or not?
I was hoping, I guess I was hoping that they would, but I knew, and actually I'd been tapped on the shoulder by multiple people online saying, I hope you're going to do this because otherwise you're going to get biased. And I was like, yes, absolutely. I'm going to talk to the employees because we know that the interpretations can be quite different. So I guess I wasn't surprised. You like to think I would have been wrong, but I guess I wasn't surprised that the views of the employer versus actually what it's like on the ground didn't always match up. So of the, I think it was 8 or 9 clinics I ended up working through that we found 3 where there was matching. Others, there were some that matched, some that didn't, and everything in between. The fourth practice, one of the reasons that never got selected to go through was only 50% of the staff engaged in the work environment survey. So I didn't feel it was enough to give a good idea of what was happening in that practice. Whereas the 3 that came through, I pretty much had 100% response rates to the survey as well, which showed a lot of staff engagement. And they were really, I felt those practices, they were very proud out of what their practices were doing, and also they felt very, very engaged in what their practices were doing as well. So they wanted to share with me what was happening. After I did that, then when I'd selected those 3 practices, then I went out to the practices as focus groups and actually talked to them more and found out a bit more about the practices.
The clinics that where there was incongruency, did you go back to the employer? Did they want to know why they weren't going another step further?
Yeah, yes, I did. One of the things that I did for each of the practices that got involved to basically give back for their time is I wrote them a report on of all of their survey data and provided that to them with feedback on where are some areas of strengths and weaknesses, so that, you know, areas that I thought maybe that they could work on. And I did open the door and said, if you want some, you know, further discussions or anything, more than happy to do that. One practice I did work with a little bit more, we had some further discussions. but none of the others opted to come back. You asked me what type of practice they were. What I'd really hoped was that we'd get a broad spectrum of companion mixed large animal practices and different ownership models. Unfortunately, we didn't. The majority were privately owned, and when we got to the final three, they were all privately owned practices. Two of them, single branches, worked entirely on their own. One of them had a buy. It started as a buying, so there was a group of practices that had a buying group, and they were starting to share HR and things, but they were very firmly, we're locally owned and operated within the area. Yeah. And I hadn't, in the initial one, I did get a club practice, and yeah, I got one club practice, the rest were all privately owned. So I wrote to all the groups and corporates and said, have you got any branches that would like to be involved? I got a response from one, and they put forward three branches. I contacted three of the branches, and only one of them got on board and did engage, but there was not congruence between what the practice manager said and what the employee said. They pretty much said that the values and things weren't being followed through on. So it was all looked really good on paper, but it didn't follow through on the ground. And the other two of the corporate branches that had been put forward both told me they didn't have enough time to be involved. What I needed from them at that point was around about an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half. An hour from just one person to give me the background of the practice and about 15 minutes from each staff member. And so it wasn't a huge amount of time. So it kind of sort of suggested to me that maybe things weren't quite as good as they could be if they couldn't spare that sort of time to hopefully improve veterinary practice as a whole.
Have you heard back from any of the employees that participated where there was incongruence?
No, I haven't, but I didn't do anything to sort of chase it up. I provided the report, which was to go to, you know, all of the staff. Some of them asked for a copy. The one practice owner asked me not to circulate it, so, you know, I didn't, you know. So, no, I haven't heard from any in particular of those practices. I've had others, since they've read the research, come forward and talk to me about how could they do some work and what could they do. But it's really interesting because at some point, you know, I've pretty much with those 10 practices, I was giving everything for nothing in return for the information. But at some point when you start involving other stuff, you know, I've got a day job as well. So you have to start asking for some reimbursement for doing that. And that seems to be a problem as well. So people don't want to invest I don't think is a lot of money, but they don't want to invest money in, you know, getting some support, because I do think support is a really important thing. Yeah. I think a lot of these practices trying to do it on their own, it's very, very hard. You almost need even just a leadership coach or a mentor or someone just to help bounce things off and to encourage them and to keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. And also I think the Kiwi psyche is we like to DIY and we are standalone, you know, we're staunch, we don't need help.
Yeah, and I can understand that. I think it's probably taken me a long time in leadership roles that I do to actually say it's, you know, although I might provide mentoring to someone else, it's quite nice to have someone myself to talk to keep growing and, confidence in what you're doing and you're on the right track, keep going, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And to show us the mirror too when we don't always see our own shortcomings. Mm.
And actually the Joe Harry's window model is quite interesting about the blind spot and things as well, you know. So getting feedback, which is, you know, one of the things around what I did with the research was asking the staff, what do you actually think? Does it match with what the employer's thinking? That's the employer's blind spot as well. So getting that from them too is really, really important.
Okay. So let's talk about well-being and how it must be a priority. And it will be good for business. So what did your research identify, highlight, show up, and prove that well-being is good for business?
I guess the background of my research wasn't to prove well-being was good for business, because there's literature out there. There's multiple amounts of literature out there, and it's listed in my research around all the articles that show that well-being is good. But I also did do some work around, okay, if we can't convince people because the literature says it's a good thing to do for business and your business will do better, how do you hold people to account that deal on a compliance level. So, you know, meeting the legal compliance. And I know compliance is a challenge in our industry, and I know people get annoyed with compliance. But when you look at compliance and peel it back, compliance is like the minimum standard. If we comply, we're sitting at the minimum standard. And so we're like, well, okay, so what laws are there? And is there a minimum standard around wellbeing? And the answer is yes, there is. Yes, it might be hard to prove, but the Health and Safety at Work Act states that you need to look after your staff wellbeing. And if a medical professional was to say that the staff burnout or whatever was related to the workplace, and I know you could end up spending years in court arguing over it, but at the end of the day, we can avoid that sort of thing happening by looking after our staff, then they could actually get a significant fine as the PCBU, so person conducting business or undertaking. So in reality, we need to move away from the conversation of should we do this or shouldn't we. It's the right thing to do, but it's also you've got to comply with the law. So either whether you like to do the right thing or whether you just like to comply, you have to do it. The literature tells you, and there's bucket loads of it out there, tells you that if you look after the staff, then the staff will look after the business for you. If you've got happy staff, the staff are happy when you come into the clinic, the culture's happy, everyone's there looking after the clients, and they're all working as a team, not as individuals that are, you know, often when the culture's a bit broken, maybe not backing each other up, so the client starts to think, oh dear, things aren't right here. The clients will come through the door because the clients want quality relationships with people that are happy, and they want to see a business that's really looking after their staff because those staff will look after their animals and the clients, you know. So we know that that will happen. So what my research did was to say, do we actually have some examples of this in New Zealand where we've got well staff and the businesses are making the money they want to make? And so I identified three practices. And could I have searched more? I bet there's more out there. I bet three is not the only number that there are. But there were three brave enough to put themselves on the line, and, you know, the data shows that they were. So what I've been able to do is present those three and say, well, you can't say it's not possible in New Zealand anymore, because I've had people say to me it's not possible to do it in New Zealand. Well, now we can say it is. And then with those three practices, I went and dug into them and go, well, what are the things about those three practices that are helping them be successful? And the first thing about it is it's not a recipe. So I can't write a recipe and say, here you go, just do this step 1, 2, 3, 4 and you'll be away. But there's themes across all of them. And it starts right at the very, very top with a very clear vision and values. But their vision and values that are not in a dusty drawer in the office, and their visions and values that are short and sweet and succinct, they're not 3 pages long. They've got to be ones that the practice owners and the staff can actually remember every day, and they can use them in their conversation. So one of the practices had one, and it wasn't, often I quite like single word ones and things. This was a little bit longer, but I thought it was a really good one for a vet clinic. And it was, we walk in, they didn't say the animal shoe, I can't remember the exact, but we walk in others' shoes, I think is what it was. We walk in others' shoes, so it could apply to animals or it could apply to people. And they said, we use that all the time because when we're out the back and maybe we're dealing with an animal that's a little bit stressed out and the vet's kind of tired and they just want to get on with it, someone can say, hang on a minute, are we walking in the animal shoes? And everyone go, oh, actually, no, we're not. So nobody got blamed at all. But we're suddenly thinking now about the animal, and now they can put the animal away and have a conversation as a team about how we're going to manage the stressful situation so it's right for the animal. And they said they use that all the time in many different contexts. And so that's an example of a value being lived every day in that practice. And they said it was great, and it meant nobody was being, you know, so you're stressing the animal out. They don't have to say that because they could just say we're not following our values today. And so that was an example of value being absolutely enacted in that practice. And, you know, caring's another quite strong one that came through in those practices. So that are we in our actions now, are we caring? Are we doing the right thing? And the right thing's not always, and one of the practices really brought this home to me, it's not always offering gold standard, gold-plated care. Sometimes it's not the right thing for the client-animal combination, and there might be a better, you know, a better option for them. And are we doing the right
thing? With the values, were these clinics hiring on those values as well?
Yes. Yeah. So I think values were very central to the interview process. And one of the things, they all told me stories where they'd made mistakes in employment, where they'd employed the wrong people and it had temporarily created an issue in their team. And it's not about trying to employ the same people. It's, you know, people that are all clones of each other. It's about employing people that really want to live by the values that the practice is espousing and actually to be part of whatever the culture is that that clinic's trying to create. So what they had all done is modified and improved and strengthened their employment processes, but the vision and values were very central around there, and they wanted to make sure that the individual's values were congruent with the practice's values as well.
Yeah. How did client well-being, patient well-being come into it at all? Obviously, patient well-being should, but
So what I did was we looked for clients' feedback on how they found the practice. So we did a survey with clients. So again, I did that for the client. We designed it with the clinic in mind, but it was basically just a, what's the best thing about the practice? What's the one thing you'd improve? And I think it was overall, how satisfied are you with the practice? And then what's the one best thing and the single thing that you would improve in the practice? And these had really, really high, strongly agree ratings of 80 to 95%, depending on the practice. And I think you're always going to get an unhappy client because the unhappy clients will always answer those surveys. So you'll actually always get a little bit of a bias. So they'll always answer. And we also looked at Facebook feedback and we looked at Google reviews as well. And we looked at what sort of feedback on there. And, you know, without fail, they had heaps of them. They weren't set up ones. You know how sometimes people go and set them up? They were ones where clients were busy telling stories. Often they'd interacted with them and, you know, thanked them for the feedback and really, really positive, really, really positive feedback about them. So there was very little negative feedback. I did go and do a little search about some of the ones that hadn't made it through with the, you know, to see. And I didn't put it in the research and it wasn't sort of a formal thing I did, so I didn't analyse it. But you could see that there was a shift in the type of feedback online from the practices that I was showcasing versus some of the others that didn't quite get through.
So with that, do you think that with the knowledge that you've gained through and the experience that you've gained with this research, that let's say you were Ms. Public and you were looking for a vet clinic, that you could read a review, a Google review or a Facebook review, and you would know whether it was a good clinic to take your animal?
I think you'd have a good idea. I think I would with anything when I look online to choose something, you know, I wouldn't just look at one review because one review is never the answer. It's looking for the theme and the feeling throughout the whole thing. But I think, you know, you can get a good feeling for a place over the online reviews for sure. And, you know, if you're a little bit objective to the fact that, you know, there's always one client that's going to go off. It doesn't matter how perfect the clinic is, and you can talk about how the clinic's managed those people at some point if you want to as well. I just thought it might be useful now when we talked about the vision and values, the other really important thing at the top of the clinic before we get down into, you know, the whole culture of the clinic is the leadership style. So the leadership style needs to be inclusive and collaborative and transformative, I guess, involving all of the staff in decision making. So even if you're, as a leader, you're absolutely sure you've got the right answer, unless it's been collaboratively decided, the team are very, very unlikely to buy into it. In fact, I talked to a practice that wasn't involved in this research afterwards. They sort of wanted to do some stuff and I had a chat to them. And one of the things they identified was actually, I'm trying to help everybody by just making the decisions and fixing everything, which is, but no one, it doesn't get bought into. And that was when the light bulb went on, because I'm not involving everybody in the decision-making process. And for some people, it can be really frustrating because it's slower if you involve everybody, but you get better buy-in. And sometimes if you set other team members up to, and this is what would happen, these guys would say, you three are going to solve, basically come up with us. We've got this, we've identified as a team, we've got this problem. You guys come up with and present us with a solution. And they got a lot better buy-in. And then that group of people would lead the implementation of it as well, and they feel much more part of the practice. One of the practices, so there were two, all of these practices, they involved the team and even strategic decision making. So it wasn't just the board around the table or the two owners or the two owners and the practice manager, but in some way, shape or form, everybody got to feed in on this strategic plan for the year, for the practice. And some of them, it was a whole day all around the table. Others, it was different ways, but it was the fact that they were involved. One of the practices, the nurses said, we want to be paid more. And the practice said, we want to pay you more too. Here's our budget. This is what we need to be making to do that. Because the nurses then identified, because they said, well, what do you want to be paid? So they identified the gap in the budget and they sat down together and they worked out how to reach the gap in the budget. I haven't caught up with them since about how they were going, but I know they were progressing. And what I did hear was the nurses felt more valued because they'd been part of the process and because now they had a value on them. So they weren't just everything for free. They had a value on them. They felt that the clients valued them better because now they were worth something. They weren't just a free advice. So the clients, yeah. And they felt really empowered towards, they could see the goal ahead of them and they knew what they had to do to get there. And it was working really well for that team. So I need to touch base with them, see how they've gone with getting those wages up. But,
so are you saying that in that clinic, the nurses were supported in being more sort of nurse practitioner, more consults?
Yes.
How long did it take?
So there were several things. There was nursing consults they were doing, but also they were looking at how they were invoicing them for outback work, you know. So rather than there being no mention of an anaesthetic technician, which is effectively what they are during surgery, that became an item that you would see.
Yeah, I talk probably, I don't know, a couple of times every week about how sadly the profession, the veterinary profession, is its own worst enemy in some cases because it does discount, it does devalue the expertise and the experience. There's no way I could do just, you know, could just put in a quick line or I could just do quick bloods. But the language is really important to me. The language that people use, everything is just and only. And it's like, please stop those words.
Yeah. And it's an I totally agree with you. The language absolutely needs to change. And we are our own worst enemies in terms of devaluing what we do. And, you know, we also say just a nurse as well. They're not just a nurse. They're a qualified veterinary nurse, you know. And, you know, and it's a bad language thing that we've got going on.
Or just a receptionist or just a cattery assistant. It's like there's no just.
Yeah. They're all professionals in their own right. And, you know, the concept of discounting, and I'm about to start some more research on that, is actually having a charity, and I'm going to call it charity model within a business, is not actually a bad thing. It's a good social thing to have. But it needs to be budgeted. It needs to not be ad hoc. It needs to be have a criteria around it. And actually, I was in Dunedin recently, and I visited a business down there, and my daughter just donated her hair for a wig down at Freedom Hair Wigs in Dunedin. And so we got to look around, and they talked about their values, and they have the section where it's formally done, where money goes into this section and might come from the business, or it might be somebody who donates here says they don't want the money, but they don't want it to go to a charity, so it goes into that charity. Or there's lots of different things that they do, and then they make sure that they can service people that can't afford their very expensive wigs but have alopecia as well through this fund. And I just believe that there must be a model like that we can do in veterinary practice too, where it's open and it's transparent. And we can do that caring stuff we really want without sort of surreptitiously cutting the bill here and there and nobody really knowing about it. So I think there's an opportunity there to harness. And like I said, I've got some research that's about to get underway on looking at what are the models that we could use in practice around that. Yeah. Because I think people like to just – so one of the practices – one of these practices that are doing quite well, they were very clear on that was an important part of their business, was to be able to – care and do the right thing and make choices about those sort of things. But it was in a much more planned, you know, the staff all understood that if they did that was going to impact that budget. And I guess that gets back to the open and transparency of businesses. Staff should have access to the operational budget. And no, not individual salaries, but just a lump, this much money, X percentage, that goes in salaries. And then there's all of these other bits. And so if we cut from there, where are we going to get the money from? And, you know, so they can actually see it. Yes, and it's scary. People don't like doing it. And
Was that one of the criteria for your research?
It wasn't one of the criteria, but these businesses were quite open and transparent about their budgets and their strategic planning. Yeah.
Did they talk about how scary that was to do to start with?
Did they talk about that? I didn't really delve into it, to be fair. I think now, you know, in retrospect, going back, I probably would have liked to delve into that a little bit more. I think culturally it's quite a sensitive thing to do because, you know, we don't share that, you know, it's sort of hidden away. Yeah. And in fact, you know, what was really interesting, it gets back to open and transparency, is in the practice, I can't actually say for sure in the practices that came out on top, but in some of the ones where there was incongruence, there was real secretiveness around job descriptions and salaries and who had this little thing and who had that little thing. Do you know? And so there was people that had benefits that others didn't have and they weren't allowed to talk about it with each other rather than having a clear structure. You go in here and you step your way up and these are the criteria to get to the next step. There certainly didn't, and that seemed to be upsetting for people. And I could understand why, because there's no clarity on why do they get that and I don't, you know? Yeah.
I sadly have seen employment contracts, individual employment contracts, where it is considered gross misconduct, so pretty much instant dismissal if an employee discusses anything in their individual employment agreement with anyone else.
And that's, to me, that sets up a culture already of secretiveness and we can't be open and transparent about things.
And it's distrust, the same. I've seen and it with secrecy, absolutely, distrust.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it goes with often in there, there's sort of individual negotiations around professional development and things too. So we can't have a clear professional development fund and we know who's getting what and where they're going and how they're, you know, there's no open and transparent plans. And so it's just the start of lots of little things that add together to make that, like you said, a big culture of distrust. Yeah.
And also there's, you know, that I guess from the employee and the owner side is if I share all of this, they're really going to see what it's like. From the employee side, a lot of people assume that because they own, you know, somebody else owns this business and the fees are X much, that they're therefore earning Y millions of dollars a year and they're going to be super wealthy. And yeah, that's not the case at all. Let's talk about, you know, we've just done a little bit on leadership, but the leaders, do you know whether the three that are leading by example, they obviously weren't born leaders, and do you know whether they took steps to improve their own leadership ability? Because I'm thinking if there's a clinician now, a principal who owns their own clinic thinking, oh, I'm not a leader, I don't even know where to start with this. How were these leaders that you spoke with?
Certainly one of them, she's done a lot of work and had mentoring and had support and that sort of thing. The other ones, I think it's been more of an osmotic type thing. But I think in the case of all of these people, they were born to be caring and kind leaders. You know, they were already like that. They hadn't been brought up in a culture of kind of that autocratic leadership where, you know, I'm the boss and I tell you what to do. So they wanted to create, two of them started the business from ground up to create that business. The other one, the other practice, it was kind of, it's a practice that's been around for a long, long time and just sort of became the two owners after lots of different partnerships and things. And I think just two very kind and caring people put a practice manager in again who they took on with the same values and just said, we want to look after wellbeing. So I don't know that they're actually having specific mentoring or coaching or anything like that, but I certainly know one of the practices is. And I think my personal opinion and from my own experience with leadership and helping other people with leadership is that having a mentor or a coach, you know, you can do a course and courses are great, but that's not enough because you do a course and you go, oh yeah, that's good, and you walk away, you haven't got anyone to help keep the momentum going with the stuff you learnt off the course. So I think, you know, for a leader, an investment in some sort of coaching or mentorship, often someone who's not in the same business as you, because
I'm so pleased you said that. Yeah.
Because otherwise you get stuck in the same hole. So you need to see things from another perspective. And I think, you know, for me working in education, I've been really lucky through the Otago Polytechnic, the leadership that I've been exposed to, quite different to the veterinary leadership I've been exposed to. And yes, bigger business and all of those sort of things, but still significantly challenged and significantly, it's not rich. We're not rich businesses. We're doing things on a line, and been very enlightening. And I think if I'd gone straight from what I'd originally thought I'd do, which was go straight from being a clinical vet to owning a practice and things, I don't think I would have been as good a leader as I think I could be now if I did it, because of the exposure I've had outside of veterinary practice. Yeah.
How would you recommend somebody start? They're listening to this and they're thinking, okay, I need to get myself a mentor, a leadership mentor. Where would they start? Where would you start?
This is where the challenge comes with veterinary practices. You don't have an HR department to go and have a chat to see who would be the best, you know, who might be some options. But, you know, I would think in the veterinary industry, you've probably got a good accountant who's got exposure to lots of different businesses, and they might know a business that's got some good values and some good leadership, and that could be a good place to start. Networking online, so through LinkedIn or other leadership forums and things like that. Attending a course, and then there might be someone at a course who you see has got a business in a different place that seems to have your values or the things you aspire to, or some of the skills you go, I haven't got those skills, and connecting with people that way. There could be some ways to do it.
Before I started with Vet Staff, I was in small business coaching, and for 7 years I ran this monthly mastermind group. It was called the Kick-Ass Mastermind, and they were all different types of businesses that had similar values within their businesses. Each month we would look at different issues, and then they would bounce around ideas from different angles, because the professions were from creative to legal to accounting, financial, health and beauty. It was the whole gamut, and just the totally different inputs that each person, because we all see things differently, and what came out of that, the change that came out of that each year was just amazing.
And the support would have been really good as well around those groups. Yeah. There are business breakfast groups in a lot of bigger areas as well, where they, you know, go and discuss things too, which can be useful as well, I think. I think it's useful to have some support from someone who's really got some knowledge as well, or can help, you know, drive them. But yes, definitely getting some support, talking to people.
If you're interested in knowing more about being part of a veterinary kick-ass mastermind group, like I mentioned when I was talking with Dr. Francesca, then please get in touch. julie.south@extra.co.nz, and I'll tell you more about it. Thank you for listening. Remember to click follow wherever you listen to your podcasts so that you don't miss out on the next show with Dr. Francesca. Next week, she'll talk more on leadership, as well as what KPIs you can start measuring in your clinic if you want to have lower staff turnover and a healthy bottom line. Also coming up on Paws, Claws, Wet Noses is Dr. Brian Greger of the Vet Podcast. Dr. Brian is a former clinic owner, now retired, living the good life and getting in as much fishing and cheese making as he can while still podcasting. As I mentioned last week, I feel really privileged, and there's a bit of a fangirl moment happening with having Dr. Brian on the show, because his podcast, the Vet Podcast, is what Paws, Claws, Wet Noses dreams of being when it grows up. But wait, there's more. Also coming up is Dr. Megan Alderson of the Strand Veterinarian in Parnell in Auckland. Dr. Megan is one of New Zealand's great advocates of and has lots of fun with the serious topic of mental health in clinic and its wellness. Ka kite anō, kia kaha, manaaki te atua. Paws, Claws and Wet Noses is sponsored by VetStaff. If you've never heard of VetStaff, it's New Zealand's only full-service recruitment agency 100% dedicated to the veterinary sector. VetStaff has been around since 2015 and works nationwide, from Cape Reinga to the Bluff and everywhere in between. As well as helping Kiwis, VetStaff also helps overseas qualified veterinarians find work in Aotearoa, New Zealand. VetStaff.co.nz.